Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
Now with this bill, the voice of justice speaks again. It proclaims that fair housing for all human beings who live in this country is now a part of the American way of life.
And with that, Lyndon Johnson signed into law the 1968 Fair Housing Act. It was designed to integrate neighborhoods and eliminate housing discrimination, both overt and unintentional. But nearly 50 years later, we still live in deeply segregated communities. So today, the Obama administration announced new housing rules. Cities and towns all over the country will have to take new measures to mix rich and poor neighborhoods. Tim Devaney is a reporter for The Hill, and he joins me now to tell us more. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
So what are these new rules in the initiative?
Yeah, well, it's really about President Obama trying to shape his legacy. The Obama administration is looking to diversify America's wealthiest neighborhood in an attempt to root out some of the last remnants of segregation that still exist more than a half century after the Civil Rights Movement.
And how will it work?
Yeah, so basically what's going on is they're going to use federal funds, you know, and grant money that local communities get, and they're going to use that as an incentive to make sure that different communities enforce the rules. And the idea is that not only are they trying to improve poorer neighborhoods by, you know, bringing in better schools and better transportation options and so forth, but they're also trying to provide affordable housing in more wealthy neighborhoods to make sure that you know, poor people have an opportunity to live in wealthy neighborhoods, or if they want to stay in the neighborhoods they're in, then they can, you know, then they have nicer neighborhoods there because those neighborhoods are also being improved.
All right, it sounds good. How expensive will the outlay be, though, for HUD for these grants, and where will the money come from?
Yeah, that's a great question. Right now, HUD's estimating that it's going to cost $25 million each year for local communities to comply with the rules, and an additional $9 million for HUD to enforce the rules. So
that doesn't sound like a lot. That doesn't sound like a lot for an ambitious program.
Yeah, not for a program when you see a lot of programs these days talking about billions and billions of dollars. It's definitely not in that range. But I think that, you know, for a lot of local communities that don't have a lot of money, that is a big deal.
And how will HUD enforce this? Because that's the issue with the Fair Housing Act in the first place, that it set a standard that was inconsistently enforced.
Yeah, that's a good question. The HUD secretary was saying that he enforcement will be a last resort, you know, in terms of he doesn't want to have to, he wants communities to, you know, just obey the rules in the first place, and he doesn't want to have to go after them. But if push came to shove, what they could do is they could restrict funding. So a lot of these communities, are receiving federal funds to improve their neighborhoods, and if they don't spend it the way that HUD sees fit, then they could lose those funds.
Well, why is this necessary? Where has the Fair Housing Act failed that this should be put into place? Because it's designed to bolster the Fair Housing Act.
Yeah, that's a good question. So the Fair Housing Act prohibits direct discrimination. So, you know, a realtor, it couldn't show, if there's a black family looking for housing, they couldn't show them, only houses in poor neighborhoods. They also have to show them houses in, you know, richer neighborhoods, basically. It's, you know, it's direct discrimination like that that it goes after. But the problem is that there's a notion called housing disparate impact, where there may be policies that don't try to discriminate against people.
And this is what the recent Supreme Court case addressed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it gets at that. And so basically the idea is that this policy is going to deal with indirect discrimination that may not be intentional, but it exists.
Well, are there particular cities that are being targeted here, cities that we know are very segregated?
You know, I'm not sure if they have, you know, particular cities in mind. I think that they are targeting, you know, the urban areas as, you know, as well as the suburbs and a lot of different cities. I don't know if there's a particular one, but obviously the mayor from Sacramento, Kevin Johnson, was on the phone call with HUD secretary when they were introducing it. So I know that, you know, that his city will be a big part of it, but I don't think that they've announced, you know, specific cities like, you know, Detroit or New York or anything like that.
Well, HUD Secretary Julian Castro said in a statement that a zip code should never determine a child's future, and that's been the soundbite accompanying this story. What do we know for sure about how much where you live determines upward mobility?
Yeah, well, you know, according to, you know, HUD and the government, they're pointing out that if you live in poor neighborhoods, you have, you know, you have less access to good education, to good jobs. You know, you're not able to maybe afford a car where you can get to, you know, the other side of town where you want to work. And so it's one of those things where it puts people at a disadvantage. And what they're trying to do is create opportunities in more affluent neighborhoods with better jobs for people to live, even if they don't have, you know, the same type of income.
And the flip side of that question is whether the segregation we see today is more racial or more economic.
That's
split
a good question.
Those two. Yeah.
You know, there's certainly, you know, the segregation that they're trying to root out, certainly a lot of it is racial segregation, but at the same time, it's beyond that. You know, it could be segregation, you know, like you said, you know, income segregation. It could be, you know, the rules technically apply not just to, you know, minorities, but also to white families that are really poor. You know, it would also benefit them.
Tim Devaney, reporter for The Hill. Thank you for this.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Well, as in many big metro areas, Los Angeles has a history of white neighborhoods working hard to keep other colors out. And that history continues to influence where Angelenos live and their economic and educational opportunities. Fernando Guerra directs the Center of the Study of Los Angeles at Loyola Marymount University, and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's start with a little history. Compton is a great example of the early housing segregation here in L.A. In the early 40s and into the early 50s, Compton, it was almost exclusively white. So how did the city conspire to keep it that way? And then what happened to change that status quo?
Well, there are all kinds of formal and informal instruments that were used by Compton and to maintain the segregation. But there was just an overwhelming amount of African Americans, mostly because of the war effort, that moved into Southern California. And they were needed for all kinds of different economic activities. And they had to live somewhere. And so in terms of going to Compton, it began to just change dramatically the ethnic makeup. And you see Compton go from being an all-white neighborhood. And it was actually not necessarily middle class, but working class. And that made it a little bit easier for everybody to conspire to have it be the chosen one, in a sense, to have this dramatic demographic shift.
And what did the white residents in Compton do? What were the more insidious ways they tried to resist this? And I'm thinking back to a house that I once bought back in Pennsylvania, actually, that said in the deed, "You cannot sell this house to Abyssinians."
Yeah, well,
and this was a way to work around whatever the laws there were about.
I who live in Westchester, the first house I bought in the deed of trust, it still said that you could not sell the house to a Negro, Mexican, Jew, or Japanese, and that was still
in there. Wow, they just came straight out.
And what's interesting, is the Supreme Court outlaw that in 1948, and yet this house was built in the early 50s, and it still had it. And even though it was against the law, they continued to do that. So there were all kinds of manners that were available, both legally in some sense, because it was considered a private contract, and that the Supreme Court and laws before that would not interfere with that private contract until that Supreme Court decision. But there was also downright physical physical abuse and threats. And so you had the whole range, everything that you've seen in the movies about the South, they were occurring here, not only in Compton, but in different other areas. And then, of course, we get to a tipping scale where it's clear that there's going to be African-American neighborhoods, and the real estate industry takes over and begins the whole practice of blockbusting, and you see the rapid change. I mean, it happens almost overnight where Compton becomes majority African-American.
And then public housing was originally, though, built in the white neighborhoods, though, like Compton, and blacks weren't allowed before that change happened. So how did that tipping point, that surge, how did the wave crest there?
What occurred there, really a lot of the public housing was because Los Angeles was growing so rapidly. And I mean, it's hard for us to imagine even today because, you know, Los Angeles actually only grew about 3% between 2000 and 2010. That is the lowest level of growth in the history of Los Angeles. It wasn't unusual for Los Angeles to sometimes even be in triple-digit percent growth over the from one decade to the other. And the population was just overwhelming, and every resource was used to try to build housing, including public housing, and mostly for returning veterans to try to get them in terms of certain neighborhoods and positions. But again, some of those were actually maintained for much longer than you would imagine, and even some that weren't necessarily public housing, but kind of similar to public housing, the La Brea apartment complex that is very well known, et cetera, was very, very white, and over the years begins to change.
So black and whites, always very segregated in this city, but what about Latinos?
Again, they begin with a history of segregation, but for a variety of different reasons, there's a little bit less resistance, and you see a little bit more integration. So if you take a look at only the segregation of African Americans is greatest, followed by Latinos, followed by Asians, and then followed by whites. While we have a tremendous amount of diversity, diversity and integration are two different things. While we have many groups in Los Angeles, they also tend to be integrated in very specific neighborhoods. And so those are two very different concepts that sometimes people mix up.
Well, sure. And the Fair Housing Act was supposed to address that. It was supposed to help integrate L.A. and other cities. Why? I have to ask, why has it failed? Or has it failed in L.A., which feels and looks like a segregated city, has one of the worst reputations on that score in the nation? Do we deserve it?
Well, actually, we don't. I mean, if you take a look at the top 100 cities, Los Angeles is about 25, and certainly segregation in every index has been lessening in Los Angeles, and even nationally, not as rapidly as we'd like to see it, but certainly it's really the older East Coast, northern cities that are the most segregated, and then the West Coast cities that are the oldest, for instance, like Los Angeles, a little bit more segregated. But the newer cities like Phoenix and Las Vegas, they are the least segregated major cities in America. And the earlier you were established with those racial prejudices that existed that were then implemented, the longer it's the more racially segregated you're going to be, and the more difficult it is to overcome that. So it's been a long history for Los Angeles, but you've seen tremendous change. You see certain neighborhoods like the city of Carson in the 1980 census was exactly one quarter white, one quarter Asian, one quarter Latino, one quarter black. In the 2010 census in Los Angeles, downtown Los Angeles was exactly one quarter Latino, one quarter Asian, one quarter black, and one quarter African American, but that's a snapshot in time. It's the trend that you see. Like in Compton, you get to a point in the mid-90s, about 1995, where Compton is actually 50% black and 50% Latino. Of course, now it's over 65% Latino, and you have constant movement of groups, mostly because of some shrinking populations and some increasing populations. And of course, the increasing populations are Latinos and Asian Americans, and the decreasing populations are whites and blacks.
Well, what do you think of this new HUD proposal and new monies available to help mix richer and poorer, economically disparate neighborhoods? Or do you have any hope that it'll make a difference here in L.A.?
No, I think so. I mean, listen, laws don't necessarily change attitudes and behaviors. Laws prevent certain types of behavior, the most egregious ones, but they don't sometimes take they cannot redo history. What's great about these new laws, it says, listen, we have all kinds of new tools, all kinds of big data, GIS. We can really track segregation and housing, the cost of housing, all aspects of housing to a much greater degree than we could ever track them, and we could even envision just even, let's say, 10 years ago. Let's use all these tools and put them into action to, number one, track and find out where we are and try to do something about this. And that's why I think earlier you mentioned how low the cost is in terms of trying to implement this. It's because you're really using new technology, new data to be able to help decision makers on where to put their resources and where they may be able to have a greater impact. The greatest difficulty, of course, is that land is just so expensive in Los Angeles, and the idea of building affordable housing, it's the only way you're going to be able to do it is to get the private sector, incentivize the private sector to include that affordable housing.
Fernando Guerra is a professor of political science and director of the Center of the Study of Los Angeles at Loyola Marymount University. You always bring so much to the show when you come on. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me.
So how are things where you live? Is your neighborhood segregated or is it pretty well integrated? Should the city do more to promote integration, and what would that be? Check in on our Facebook page, or you can tweet us at KCRW Press Play. Just ahead, there are still a few oil fields in Los Angeles, but only one that has a 100-year-old house in the middle of it. The story behind the mysterious Baldwin Hills oil house. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. We just heard about housing segregation in Los Angeles. Now a completely different kind of housing story. There is a century-old home hidden in the middle of an oil field in the middle of the city. Few people know it's there. Even fewer know its history. Today, we unpack the mystery. Press Play producer Anna Scott has the story.
Kenneth Hahn State Park in Baldwin Hills might be one of the most unusual places in L.A. It's a gorgeous green park full of trees and hiking trails. But when you look out at the view from those trails, you see acres of industrial-looking oil rigs. The park is right next to the huge Inglewood oil field. It looks like a slice of Bakersfield or West Texas plopped right in the middle of LA. And if that isn't surprising enough, there's something else. If you stand in the park and you look at the oil field from the right angle, you'll see that there's a house on it. Yes, a house on the oil field right near some wells, and not a little shack, but a hulking brick house with white trim and a green pointed roof. So, who on earth would build a house in the middle of a huge oil field? I went to the park and asked some hikers there if they knew anything about it.
Yeah, it's to the right.
What do you think that is?
I have no idea, but it looks like a big house. It looks like an old house.
I've never noticed it. It looks kind of weird.
I don't know, but my sister was telling me a story about some house that's in the middle of the oil fields. I could call my sister up and she could tell you.
This lady from KCRW is here when she's asking questions.
He called his sister, but she didn't know much. She said the house is really old, maybe from the 1800s. If that's true, then it was built way before the oil field came to be. The sister also said that the house now gets used as a location for film and TV shoots. And indeed, it turns out the house has a website for location scouts, baldwinhillsoilhouse.com. The site says the home was built in 1896, but nothing else about its history. The contact person listed, Liz Gosnell, told me the owners do not do press, and the house is behind oil field security gates, so you can't just walk up to it. Somebody has to know something about this huge house in the middle of an oil field in the middle of L.A.
We were looking for the scary house on the hill.
Vincent Jeffords is a production designer for the TV show Criminal Minds. He was looking for a scary house on a hill, and he got one. A rambling 5,000-square-foot home with a patio, with dark wooden beams along the ceilings and multiple fireplaces.
It's a really strangely situated house. It's an old brick, four-bedroom, kind of a small mansion. And it just sits in this barren industrial landscape of these pumps just pumping away and these old shaggy eucalyptus trees. The story that I heard was that an East Coast judge had moved out. He was married, but he had a mistress, and he built the house and it was going to install his mistress in this house. But they also heard that there were hidey holes in the old fireplace. There were places to hide stuff. Yeah, places to hide things. That may have been to hide booze. I don't know. Anyway, it's an odd house. It has a very weird house and a very weird vibe. A spooky old house.
I can remember some nights there were, like, you know, strange creakings and, you know, like footsteps on the second floor.
Eric Parley lived at the house. He subleased a room there for a few years in the early 80s.
You know, at night you'd just sort of hear the lull in the distance of all of these electric pumps pumping the wells. And it was actually kind of, you know, we literally could lull you to sleep. You just had, you know, almost like miles and miles of roads that you could drive on. And once you got in behind the gates, it was like being inside this crazy estate with beautiful views. I mean, you could see the Hollywood sign. You could see, you know, out towards the ocean and everything. It was pretty amazing.
Did you hear, you know, rumors or snippets about the house's history? Or
I had gotten some of the stories. I vaguely remember that somebody had committed suicide there. And maybe the scene of that was actually in the basement. I don't know. But I always had heard that it was Harrison Gray Otis that built the house for his buddies.
Yes. He just said Harrison Gray Otis, publisher of the LA Times in the late 18 and early 1900s, patriarch of the Chandler family, LA royalty. So now I've talked to someone who's lived at the house. I've talked to someone who's worked there. I've heard these intriguing rumors, but I still don't really know anything about this huge house in the middle of a huge oil field. The house doesn't have an address, so it's hard to track down any property records. The LA Conservancy, a preservation organization, has never heard of it. So many dead ends. Until I found someone who seemed to know something. This person had been posting all kinds of details about the house on a website I stumbled on after many Google searches called the Skyscraper Forum.
My name is Mike Davison. I grew up in the area and remember being in the car driving through La Cienega, through the Baldwin Hills, and seeing that house in the middle of the oil field and always wondering why it was there.
Mike Davison isn't a historian. He's not a professor. He's a 53-year-old guy who's worked as a writer and in banking, and history's his hobby. For the past few years, he's extensively researched the house on the oil field. He's combed through map books that the county keeps in a basement downtown. He's pieced together nearly century-old newspaper articles and writings by obscure local historians.
The man who built the house was named Charles Wellington Rand. Approximately from August 1914 through January 1915 is when the house was built.
At that time, the house would have sat high above miles and miles of rolling hills. No oil drilling yet, no real estate development, just a quiet country landscape.
And who is this Charles Rand? What did he do?
He was a lumber baron from Iowa. How you get to be a lumber baron in Iowa, I'm not sure. His father died when he was 12. His mother moved himself and his older brother and younger sister out to Los Angeles to live with her father. His name was Hiram Higgins. He lived about two blocks west on Wilshire Boulevard from where General Harrison Gray Otis lived, the publisher of the Los Angeles Times. And apparently just through being neighbors, the two families got to be very close.
Is that why there's this rumor out there that that house on the oil field was owned by a Chandler family person?
That may be part of it. Harrison Gray Otis's son-in-law was Harry Chandler. Harry Chandler's nephew was Ralph Chandler. Ralph Chandler and Charles Wellington Rand became friends. They also, Rand and Ralph Chandler, were partners in an automobile business on Flower Street. After Rand passed away, Ralph Chandler may have used the house. There's also a rumor that in the 40s and 50s, Norman Chandler, who was Harry Chandler's son and publisher of the Times at the time, hid a secret second family in that house. I haven't seen any proof of it. That's the rumor that may be also part of why it's thought to be a Chandler-built house, but Rand definitely is the man who built the house.
Aha. So all these rumors of a Chandler family connection, of a mistress, it's all coming together. But who were these people, really?
A lot of society column issues about Mrs. Rand, her travels. She liked to travel around the world, go to Europe for months at a time. I'm not sure I would have liked her. She doesn't seem like a very likable person. She left her young children alone a lot to go travel after their father died, and doesn't seem to have been a very good mother, if you ask me.
So what happened to Rand?
As I said, I don't think he had a particularly easy life. He eloped in 1911 with a young woman who, 3 weeks after their elopement, admitted she had not gotten a divorce from the person she was actually married to. So, and that relationship apparently ran hot and cold until 1917. He finally got an annulment in early 1917. So his personal life seems to have been somewhat unsettled.
His life was unsettled, and it didn't end well.
In October 1917, October 3rd to be exact, he changed his will to leave everything he had to his mother and his sister, presumably from his now ex-wife. And on October 5th, 1917, he shot himself in the head with a shotgun and killed himself in the house in the Baldwin Hills.
After Rand died, his family sold the house to a woman named Emma Cohn and her husband Irving in 1923. Their relatives still own the house today. The Cohns, it turned out, had very good timing. They signed the first oil lease in Baldwin Hills in 1924, and now the house sits in the center of the biggest urban oil field in the country. Still a spooky old house on a hill, but also a very valuable one. For Press Play, I'm Anna Scott.
Coming up, heroin addiction is surging in the U.S. Heroin overdoses have increased fourfold in the last decade. The number of women using the drug has doubled. And much of this is driven by widespread access to prescription painkillers. Some scientists say medical marijuana might help reduce this trend. That conversation after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. The country is in the midst of an epidemic. It's not measles or the flu or any contagious disease. It's heroin addiction. The rate of heroin use among women doubled over a decade, according to a new study published this week. It has also more than doubled among whites, and it grew 60% among middle-class households. Tom Frieden, director of the Center for Disease Control, said in a news conference yesterday that there are two reasons for the uptick.
First is an increasing number of people primed for heroin addiction because they're addicted to or exposed to prescription opioid painkillers. And second is an increase in the supply and accessibility and a decrease in the cost of heroin.
Colleen Barry is Associate Chair for Research and Practice at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, and she joins us now to talk about this. Welcome to the show.
Great to be talking to you.
Sam Quinones joins us as well. He's a journalist and author of the book Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. And thank you for coming on Press Play.
My pleasure.
Colleen, I'd like to start with you. What do you find of interest in these new heroin stats? Is there anything surprising here?
I think this report is really interesting, and it provides information for the public on some data that researchers have understood for the last few years, which is that the face of addiction in America is much more diverse than we tend to believe or understand. And addiction, I think, can touch, as this report suggests, people from all walks of life. And so I think getting that information out there is critical. And I think the two points that were just made about the epidemic of prescription pain medications like OxyContin and Vicodin driving this epidemic of heroin, and the point related to changes in supply and price are critical to understanding the problem.
And tease that out for us. People are relying on prescription painkillers. Doctors are willing to prescribe them. And then when they can't get them, what happens then? And how does the cost of heroin figure into that?
Yeah, so we have much more availability of these medications than we used to. They've been prescribed at a much higher rate, and that has translated into a national public health crisis. Opiate overdose deaths have quadrupled over the last few years, and this problem is just a major epidemic. Deaths from drug overdoses have become the leading cause of injury death in the U.S., killing more adults than car crashes. What has happened is that heroin has become a less expensive and more readily available alternative to individuals who often, without a great awareness of the high potential of these medications to become addicted, have become addicted following back pain, a car accident, that in turn has translated into a rise in heroin addiction and in heroin overdose.
Well, Sam Quinones, where are we seeing this rise in heroin play out most dramatically? And are there certain cities that just highlight this trend?
I would say one thing about this. The report doesn't quite say this, but I believe this certainly is true, that this is actually entirely white people. There's almost nobody, very few, let's put it that way, in the Latino or black community that's really been afflicted in this way. I'm aware of very few Asians addicted in this way. It's almost entirely a white phenomenon. Now, it can be low-income whites in Appalachia, which is where it began back in the late 90s, and no one really paid any attention. It then spread to very wealthy suburbs and communities that did extremely well over the last 20 years in the run-ups, economic run-ups that we've had. I'm thinking Salt Lake City, Indianapolis, Charlotte, places like that. The amazing thing is that this is because of what Dr. Berry was talking about, because of the expansion of prescribing of these pills by legitimate doctors, I think well-meaning and certainly the majority. The pills are everywhere. I mean, they're all over. They're in Alabama, they're in Vermont, they're in Tennessee, you know, and that's where heroin now is. That's what's led. Heroin is no longer, you know, simply a New York drug or a Tenderloin San Francisco drug or East LA drug. This is suburbs, rural America. You're finding it in some of the best parts. I was in Charlotte for my book. I was in Charlotte, North Carolina. That's a town that is the second leading banking center after New York City. The places where most of the addicts come from are the wealthiest zip codes of Charlotte. So you're seeing this. I would say, though, that one thing the report does not make clear and ought to is that this is almost doesn't touch the Latino and black communities at all. It's entirely, almost entirely a white phenomenon.
It's so interesting. It's like a paradigm shift. Colleen Berry, one obvious difference in and what's driving the difference in heroin use than what we saw in the 60s and 70s is our changing laws about marijuana and the availability of medical marijuana. And you co-authored a study last year that found that states with medical marijuana saw a 25% reduction in opioid deaths, including heroin. And that's just sounds like such a significant number. Tell us about that research.
Yeah, so many individuals receive narcotic prescription pain medications to manage chronic pain, and we were interested in looking at how the availability of medical marijuana as an alternative to prescription narcotics for pain management could affect overdose deaths. We hypothesized that the passage of these laws in states could lead to reduction in overdose deaths since medical marijuana is not susceptible in the same way to unintentional overdose that we've seen for the Vicodin and the OxyContin types of narcotic medications. And so using death certificate data compiled by the CDC, we found first what everybody else has seen, that the rates of opiate overdose deaths have increased exponentially across all states over our study period, which was 1999 to 2010. But as you said, the yearly rate of opiate overdose deaths from prescription painkillers and heroin in states with these medical marijuana laws was substantially lower on average than the rate in states without these laws. And in absolute terms, the size was substantial. States with medical marijuana, with a medical marijuana law in place, had about 1,700 fewer opiate overdose deaths in 2010 alone than would have been expected based on trends before the laws were passed.
Well, I was trying to absorb your research with the news out today, which found that people who are addicted to marijuana are three times more likely to also be addicted to heroin, and people who take opioids are 40 times more likely to use heroin. So how do these stats square with your findings that taking marijuana, using marijuana can help keep people from using painkillers?
Yeah, that's a great point. So nearly all the people who use heroin also use at least one other drug. So this is an important finding of this report and important for thinking about how to get this group of individuals into effective treatment. And certainly medical marijuana laws can be controversial, and opponents of them have raised concerns of promotion of cannabis use, in particular among kids. And I think our study suggests that medical marijuana in particular may have an unintended benefit as well. So, you know, I don't think anyone in the medical marijuana industry, and certainly not me as a researcher, would suggest that marijuana and recreational marijuana use doesn't come with substantial risks. But medical marijuana laws have been passed to give people with some painful chronic conditions such as cancer, multiple sclerosis, glaucoma, access to effective treatment, and cannabis is believed to have pain-killing properties. So I think we need to sort of think about both of these risks and benefits in tandem and design laws to try to manage them, the risks and benefits in tandem.
Well, Sam Quinones, what's your reaction? What do you think about what we're hearing from Colleen?
Well, I think it's interesting. Yes, I would make that differentiation that we have a lot of people who are smoking marijuana. A lot of people are pretending to have pain and are using marijuana through the medical marijuana in California. This is the abuse of that is rampant. I would say. I would also say that one problem that we have in the United States, in California, maybe in other states that have legalized it, Washington and Colorado, is that the THC levels of marijuana now are so high these are massive doses of THC that you're getting with 30% THC when in 70s it was more like 3 or 5%. I think this may also be part of the slide into heroin. I don't know that. I've never done a study on it, but it seems like logical that if you're smoking this massive amount of THC and taking it into your system, that maybe this is part of what leads to this. Medical marijuana is a when used properly and under doctor's care and in the proper way, I believe can be, though I've heard, my understanding is talking with patients, can be an effective substitute for some of these opiate painkillers.
Well, Colleen Berry, what policies are floating out there that could make an impact or potentially bigger impact on the use of the rise of the use of prescription painkillers and the prevalence of it?
Yeah, so there are a number of really important policies out there that have evidence supporting them and deserve consideration. One point that I, and I'll mention those, one point I want to just very briefly make is that alongside this epidemic that this report has focused on, we need to make sure that people with legitimate pain problems can get access to effective pain treatments. And I think the big fear within the pain community is we're going to crack down in a way that's going to put people with real pain at risk. So I just wanted to make that point. In terms of dealing with the epidemic of prescription drug.
And I'm afraid I've only left you 30 seconds for that.
Yeah. And heroin epidemic, I think we need much better access to effective treatments, including medication-assisted treatments, broader passage of naloxone distribution policies to help people in overdose, prescription drug monitoring programs, changes in the way doctors prescribe, and law enforcement activities to crack down on pill mills and other deceptive practices. Together, these policies can really make a major difference in combating the epidemic.
And I'd like to have you both back to talk about that in detail. Colleen Barry, she's Associate Chair for Research and Practice at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. Sam Quinones is a journalist and author. His newest book is Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, Warren. Olney, what are you talking about today on the show?
Well, we are going to be talking about Iran. We are wondering, of course, is there going to be an Iranian nuclear deal or is there not? And Iran, they're
these
really
endless
flying
deadlines, right?
Yeah. So deadline after deadline has been missed. The Iranians, arguably, need the deal more than we do, and they are playing a waiting game. So we're going to find out what that means to them and how important this is to that country of 80 million people.
Thank you for that.
Indeed.
And just ahead on our show, even though Marvel has opted out, Comic-Con will start tomorrow and it will be as Hollywood and superhero heavy as usual. We have a preview. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. Comic-Con starts tomorrow. Thousands of fans will be flocking to San Diego, many of them in capes or cowls, not to mention studios and TV networks, and those execs will probably leave their capes at home. This year, a major player isn't coming, Marvel Studios. Here to talk about who isn't there, but mainly who and what is Jermaine Lucier, entertainment reporter for io9.com. And it's nice of you to join us.
Thank you so much for having me, Barbara.
Well, I know you're about to head down, so I appreciate you doing this before you get in the car. As I mentioned, Marvel Studios won't be joining you on the freeway. Why are they sitting this year out?
Yeah, I mean, it's very disappointing because in the last couple of years, Marvel on Saturday night in Hall H of Comic-Con has always been the highlight. They've always had the biggest announcements, the best presentations. It's been a spectacle. And this year, I guess, they just don't have enough. They have a movie in production now for next May called Captain America Civil War. And then the movie after that they're releasing doesn't come out until November of 2016, Doctor Strange. That hasn't started filming yet. So they don't have enough. Plus they did this huge announcement last October of all the movies they have coming out through 2019. So they sort of spent all their news. Plus Disney has their own convention, similar to Comic-Con, that's only Disney, called D23 Expo, that happens next month in Anaheim. And I think Marvel is going to be there with some footage. But in spirit, Marvel Comics will be there.
Of course. But, yeah. And I'm sure the other studios are just devastated that Marvel isn't coming and won't be sucking up all the media attention. So what are the big draws since Comic-Con won't be all about the Marvel juggernaut?
Well, it's actually interesting, though. Like I said, Marvel Studios usually take Saturday night in Hall H. And now this year, that spot is being taken by 20th Century Fox, who, in an odd way, is actually bringing their own Marvel presentation. Fox bought a bunch of Marvel properties before Marvel Studios started making their own movies, which is Paramount and then now Disney. So they have three big movies that are either coming out soon or in production that they'll be bringing to Comic-Con. So Saturday night will be a Marvel thing. It just won't be a Disney Marvel. So those movies are The Fantastic Four, which comes out in August, Deadpool, which comes out in February, and then X-Men Apocalypse, which comes out next May. So those are, I mean, fans, I think, are very, very excited to have a different sort of spin on Marvel this year at Comic-Con. That's definitely the first of the big draws this year.
There's also a new World of Warcraft movie, right, adapted from the huge game franchise. I haven't heard about this very much. I understand it's been a long time in the works.
Yeah, Warcraft is being directed by Duncan Jones, who's David Bowie's son, and he did a couple great movies called Moon and Source Code. And Yeah, he's been making this movie for around 3 years, say, roughly, and he's actually been at Comic-Con the last 2 years. 2 years ago to show just a brief little, like, you know, hey, I'm excited to be here. Last year, sort of, they showed some animatic-type trailer, but this year, the movie's finally coming out soon, and by soon, I mean in Comic-Con terms, which is June 2016. And so he's going to be there, and they're going to finally show footage from this movie based on this game that has millions and millions of players, and everybody is very, very scared, but also very excited to see what Jones has been working on.
Well, I imagine it will involve blood, too. What about the established movie franchises? Who will be previewing clips? And I'm thinking Star Wars, of course, right, is a big name in this year.
Absolutely. I mean, Star Wars actually hasn't had a movie presentation at Comic-Con for over a decade. Last time they were there, 2004, for Revenge of the Sith. And this year, they're finally back. J.J. Abrams will be there. Lucasfilm president Kathleen Kennedy will be there. However, Entertainment Weekly has been reporting that they will not show any new footage from the movie, which is disappointing. But at the same time, they know that Comic-Con is a very important audience. A lot of influential people are going to be in that room. And apparently they're going to be taking a behind-the-scenes track on Star Wars The Force Awakens. And rumor has it, bring out the majority of, if not all, the cast. Could that mean Harrison Ford returns to Comic-Con? That would be great. And he's very curious that on Tuesday, Disney announced that the directors of the Lego movie are going to be making a Han Solo movie in 2018. The timing of that 2 days before Comic-Con seems a little curious to me, so I wonder if maybe we'll hear more about that, too.
Well, Walking Dead, Game of Thrones, they're obviously still going strong and probably the most popular comic and fantasy series ever on TV. And you're going to be going to panels for both, I see. What are these panels like now that they've just both become such juggernauts? Is it all about people trying to get somebody to leak a spoiler?
Yeah, it's kind of like that. They're both actually, the panels for each of them are very different because The Walking Dead has this new season just coming up, probably in October, I believe, while Game of Thrones just finished. So the panels are a very opposite end of the spectrum. The Walking Dead is much easier. They'll have a trailer for the new season. They'll have the cast there to tease the new season. And so that'll be exciting. They also have a new spinoff TV show coming up called Fear the Walking Dead, and that will be at Comic-Con. And then Game of Thrones, which is obviously a huge hit, but that season just ended, so everybody wants to know about what just happened, the characters that died.
Jon Snow dead or not?
Yes, dead or not. That's a big mystery. Will Kit Harington show up at Comic-Con? We don't know.
And his hair.
If he does, will they say anything? And his hair. Very, very true. But the thing is, the Game of Thrones panels are usually kind of boring because they don't have any footage. They'll usually do some sort of blooper reel and Q&A session, which can be fun, but it's usually not great. Comic-Con is really just about wowing the fans with something new and exciting. And Game of Thrones, unfortunately, they're not going to go into production for the new stuff for some months now.
Well, now that Comic-Con is such a big Hollywood-drenched event, is it less or more exciting?
I think it's more exciting if you have the patience. It's gotten so incredibly big that it's all about how you approach it.
And since it's now really straight in the center of popular culture as opposed to outsider culture, do you even experience that sense of outside culture at all?
No, you really don't. Like you said, it's incredibly mainstream. I mean, there used to be a time when a movie website or entertainment website could get a lot of great access at Comic-Con. But since the major movie outlets all go down there, Entertainment Tonight, Extra, Entertainment Weekly, since these guys are now dominating Comic-Con, it's just become all of the big coverage. The niche stuff is there. It just is buried by this mountain of mass media. So I think the subculture that Comic-Con started as is definitely there. There's no doubt about it. It's just about finding it amidst this mass of craziness.
Well, Jermaine, drive safe down to San Diego, and thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Barbara. Great talking to you.
Great talking to you. Jermaine Lucier, entertainment reporter for io9.com. Hello, Christian Bordahl.
Hello, Barbara Bogave.
What do you have for us?
Well, we started the show today looking at the Fair Housing Act and the new HUD initiative to try to reduce housing segregation. And you talked to Fernando Guerra, who runs the Center for the Study of Los Angeles at Loyola Marymount.
He's fantastic. He's just a wealth.
Really interesting guy. He knows it all about segregation and integration here in LA. And he pointed out, while we're an incredibly diverse city, that's not the same as being integrated. But interestingly, he told me that some of the newer cities around LA are more integrated, like Irvine, for example, which we all think of as kind of white, but in fact, it's really integrated. And one of our listeners, Ronald Wilkinson, says he's lived and raised boys in West Ventura, and he says that's really diverse. And Glenn Habis, hope I'm pronouncing that right, he lives in Palms on the west side, and he says, despite our popular conceptions about West LA, Palms is probably the most diverse area he's ever lived in. It's got Latinos and African Americans, Brazilians, Asians, Middle Easterners, South Asians, and he says incomes range the gamut as well. So that's one of the reasons that he loves to live in that area.
And that's what's so wonderful about LA. It's so huge, you hardly ever can encompass all of it.
Exactly.
It's great
There's
to hear
so
these voices from the neighborhoods.
And so many different colors and creeds. All of us have come here to Los Angeles.
Well, thank you so much for that.
Absolutely.
And thank you for this week. We're going to wrap up now. Madeline comes back tomorrow. It's just been a pure pleasure being with all of you here this past few weeks, and I'll see you next time. And stay tuned for To the Point with Warren Olney. It's up next here on KCRW and KCRW.com.